I'm Meghna Chakraborty, and this is On Point. Ken Farley, what feelings get stirred up in you? What gets evoked in you when you hear those sounds?
Overwhelmingly, it is a feeling of loneliness. This is what Mars sounds like, and it's a completely isolated place. And those are the only sounds that we have ever heard from another planet.
Wow. Loneliness. Okay. Well, let's go back for a second and listen to that first one again. Okay, Ken, so what is that?
That is the wind blowing across the microphone.
That's the Martian wind. Wow. Okay, and this one? What's that creaking and clanking noise?
I have to tell you, we struggled for a while figuring out what we were recording there. That is the sound of the Perseverance rover driving across the Martian landscape. And you can hear the screeching sound, which is the suspension system. And the more clanky sound is as the wheels drive over rocks.
I know you said loneliness, but why loneliness? I'm kind of in awe. I didn't really feel loneliness, an amazement about what you've accomplished.
There's definitely an element of that. And I have to say, I was surprised when actually my wife mentioned to me, she said, you know, it sounds lonely. And I just can't get that feeling out of my head. And I guess that's because I feel like I'm there. We have the rover there. We're, of course, not humans standing on Mars, but we are experiencing a new sense for the first time. And that's the emotion it brought to me.
Wow. Well, I mean, when you think about it, it makes sense, right? Because it took 7 months traveling a distance of 300 million miles before Perseverance made its absolutely gorgeous landing on the Martian surface on February 18th. And folks, Ken Farley is the geochemist and Caltech professor and project scientist for the Mars 2020 mission and the Perseverance rover. And those sounds that we just heard that Perseverance sent back is just a taste of the mountains of data that his team are going to be pouring over for years to come, I'm sure. So, Ken, first of all, just let me give you a formal welcome to On Point and congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
I know you've heard a lot of congratulations, but I have to say, when I watched the actual video that was sent back of the landing of Perseverance, I watched it over and over and over again. It was spectacular. I mean, were you just like so relieved when it went off without a hitch?
Oh, of course. 7 months of travel to Mars was preceded by 8 years of development, and a huge investment by a huge number of people really paid off. It was a great day.
It was so cool to watch. I mean, like the would-be engineer in me was like, oh, my God, look at this. Okay, first of all, it does the descent through Mars's atmosphere, and we'll talk about what's in its atmosphere. Then it releases the heat shield. Then you have the parachute. And then my absolute favorite part is that last, what was it, 20 meters or so? Can you describe how it actually finally made that touchdown on the red soil of Mars?
Yeah, it uses what we call the sky crane maneuver, which is when we are a few tens of meters off the surface, we have retro rockets firing with the rover mounted on a platform, and we literally winched the rover down to the surface until it touched the ground. And then as soon as we got the signal that it had touched the ground, we cut the cables, and the rocket engine bearing stage flew off and crashed, leaving the rover standing by itself on the surface.
Oh, my God. I'm never going to outgrow my like 12-year-old self when I hear about these kinds of accomplishments in other parts of our solar system. It is so great. Now, folks, Ken's going to be with us for the hour. So hop on social media on Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. And if you have questions about the Perseverance mission, let us know, because I've got a lot, but definitely want to hear from you as well. So first of all, Ken, let's get some of the basic who, what, when, where, and whys out of the way. Where is Perseverance right now, and why did you choose that particular landing spot location?
Perseverance landed in a crater that's about 40 kilometers across called Jezero Crater. And there is very clear evidence that this crater was once filled with a lake, and it got quite a large lake, 40 kilometers across and hundreds of meters deep. And this was about 3.5 billion years ago. Since that time, Mars climate has changed completely. There's no liquid water on the surface of Mars anymore. But at this time, 3.5 billion years ago, we believe this was a very habitable environment.
Okay, so just to be clear, because you said it, but I want to be clear, a water lake, an H2O lake, not some other substance.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the surface was warm enough and clement enough to have liquid water flowing on its surface.
Wow. And 3.5 billion years ago, and there's something really important about that particular time frame.
Well, the importance is that was pretty much the last time that abundant liquid water was on the surface. The planet completely dried up, desiccated, froze in a massive event of climate change. And we are seeking evidence of life in that former lake environment.
Evidence of life. Okay. And what kind of life are we talking about?
Well, that's a really good question. This is not Earth-like life we are seeking. And that forces us to think a little bit differently. But all we really have to go on is Earth's life. We have an example of one of what life is like. And 3.5 billion years ago on Earth, that is about the oldest evidence we have of life on Earth. And life at that time was strictly microbial. Life had not evolved into the kind of complex, plants and animals that we're familiar with today. That came much, much later. So using Earth as an analogy, we think the most plausible kind of life that might exist that early in the history of the solar system is likely to be microbial.
We're talking it's like single-celled microbes.
Exactly. Okay. And they at least on Earth, the reason we can identify them relatively easily is that they form colonies that live together, and that makes them easier to detect at the macroscopic scale.
Okay, so let's just stay here, Earth side here for a second. How do you identify where and how have we identified those ancient microbes as evidence of early life on Earth?
The most important thing to understand is that Earth's a very dynamic planet, and there is very little rock record of the very distant past. In Earth's history, the time when life presumably originated and got its start, most of that rock record is gone. There are a few places, including in Western Australia, where there are small slices of rock from that time period. And in those rocks that record shallow lakes or seas, microbes were growing, and they were actually deforming the mud on which they were growing. And this deformation by the presence of these microbes left a pattern in the rocks that at the scale of inches to feet that is characteristic of this mat of organisms and very different than the structure that you get from deposition of sediment that is not induced or modified by biology.
Okay. We're going to, after our first break here, we're going to talk more about the question of life, early life on Mars with you and an astrobiologist. But we've already got some great questions coming in from listeners. Christopher Maxwell wants to know about those sounds that we played, Ken. He says, what did you plan to hear with the microphone?
Well, this is a great story. The videos which you referred to a moment ago of the landing,
yeah,
and some of the recordings we've released, they are essentially recorded. Both of them, the imagery and the audio, are recorded with an off-the-shelf camera system. And what that means is a very low cost. Does not have to work, but it would be nice if it did work. And so we went in thinking, well, let's record the sights and sounds of entry, descent, and landing. And the system worked. And we have the microphone still functioning on the rover. And now we can listen to the wind, which is it does actually tell us some characteristics of the wind that are scientifically interesting. But it is also opening a completely new way to diagnose the health of the rover. There are many mechanisms on the rover that make noises that the engineers are very interested in. How are the bearings doing, or is the compressor working as we expect? And so we're just learning how to use it. It's not put on primarily as a science instrument. It was put on as a way to learn something new about about a different sense than we've ever had before.
Oh, that is fantastic. And now though the happy happenstance, if I can put it that way, is that you might get some great science out of it too.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Excellent, interesting results that we're getting, not only from sounds like the wind, but we also fire a laser at the rock surfaces to learn of their chemical composition. And when the laser interacts with the rock, it makes a popping sound. So when we fire the laser, it goes pop, 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 pop.
And you're actually hearing it. That's awesome. And there was another image. We've just about 30 seconds before the break here, Ken. But there was another image I saw that NASA released of an orbital image of the parachute of the parachute of the descent. Actually, had you ever seen a landing from that point of view?
The high-rise camera on the orbiter that you refer to has captured the parachute from the previous rover mission, Curiosity. And so we can actually see a number of different components that we essentially shed during entry, descent, and landing.
Okay. Well, Ken Farley joins us today. He leads the science team on the Perseverance mission to Mars. We'll have a lot more when we come back about the question of life on the red planet. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are exploring the question of whether there's evidence of ancient microbial life on Mars. And I'm privileged to be joined by Ken Farley because he is the project scientist with NASA's Mars 2020 mission. We've been talking about the information they're already getting back from the Perseverance rover, which landed on the surface of the red planet in February. We're going to talk about life a little bit more in just a couple of minutes. But Ken, there were several other tech demos associated with this mission that I want to talk about just briefly before we then dive into the question of life on Mars. So let's talk about MOXIE here for a second. And that is the demo that's trying to show that you can create oxygen from carbon dioxide on Mars. And we spoke with Michael Hecht. He's with MIT's Haystack Observatory and the principal investigator of MOXIE. Again, that's a device that's embedded in the belly of the Perseverance rover. And just a week ago, it in fact successfully converted carbon dioxide from the Martian atmosphere into oxygen. And Heck says this goes a long way in the question of making oxygen for astronauts to breathe.
A much larger consumer of oxygen is the rocket that will take our astronaut crews and lift them off of the surface of Mars and bring them home. That rocket could use for four astronauts could use 25 tons or more of oxygen. That's a lot of oxygen to have to bring to Mars. We'd rather make it there. You know, the astronauts are even more important, of course, but they won't use more than a ton or a ton and a half.
Ken Farley, you want to talk about this experiment a little? It seems pretty exciting.
Yeah, it is part of Perseverance's goal to test technologies that will, as we say, enable the future. And the MOXIE investigation tests this concept of using electricity to convert an abundant resource, the Martian atmosphere, into oxygen. And as Mike Heck just said, this is a way to make it much more economical to get all of the gear and supplies that are necessary for a human exploration sometime in the future.
Mm. Later in the show, we're going to talk about whether or not we should actually be thinking or moving towards human colonization of Mars. But let's also take a minute to talk about Ingenuity. Should we call it a helicopter? Should we call it a drone? What should we call it?
We call it a rotorcraft.
A rotorcraft, okay.
I'm careful about calling it a drone because people have a conception in their head of maybe what they can buy at the hobby shop. Because Mars' atmosphere is so thin, this is very different than what you would buy in a hobby shop. The blades are more than a meter across. So it's a very big dual blade rotorcraft.
And Christopher Maxwell again. Christopher, thank you for your great questions, by the way. And if anyone else has questions about the Perseverance mission for Ken, again, we're on Twitter at Facebook at On Point Radio. Christopher wants to know, how did you actually test Ingenuity here on Earth? Because the Martian atmosphere is so much less dense.
That is actually an excellent question, because in order to test it in anything like the true conditions on Mars, you have some serious hurdles. The first is you need a very large vacuum chamber. If you want to fly up to a height of 10 meters, which is what Ingenuity is doing on Mars, you know, that's a gigantic chamber to pump down. And then you need to get it to very low temperatures. The surface of Mars is a few tens of degrees below freezing. So it's very cold. And then you have the whole issue of gravity, which is substantially lower on Mars than on Earth. So it's very hard to do a full-up test, but some small-scale tests were done on Earth before we took Ingenuity to Mars.
Okay, fantastic. Now, let's get back to our focus on life, or the question of whether there was life on Mars some 3.5 billion years ago. You mentioned, Ken, that after that time, Mars went through, you called it climate change. So first of all, tell me more about what Martian climate change actually means, and how did that happen?
Well, here's what we know. Okay. We know that currently Mars is extremely cold. It's extremely dry. And the surface has nowhere that life as we know it could exist. And that one of the great surprises of the several decades of exploration of Mars is that it wasn't always that way. And we see what is really textbook evidence of flowing water on the surface in the distant past. About 3.5 billion years ago, we see canyons. Mm-hmm. We see evidence of shorelines on lakes and a possible ocean that covered part of the planet. And in the case of Jezero Crater, where Perseverance landed, we see evidence of a river delta, which is proof positive that there was once a lake in that crater. So clearly, climate has changed sometime between then and now. We believe it was in the vicinity of between three and three and a half billion years ago that the climate changed. We don't know exactly why. In fact, one of the great questions is how Mars was ever warm enough to host liquid water on its surface. But one of the leading candidates for the explanation of why Mars climate changed is that it lost its magnetic field. Uh-huh. The loss of the magnetic field actually causes a partial loss of the atmosphere. And this simply drives home the point that the way climates work on planets is through greenhouse warming. And when you change the composition or the density of the atmosphere, you change the climate.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Ken, hang on here for just a second, because now I want to bring into the conversation Don Sumner, who joins us from Davis, California. Don is a professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of California, Davis, and her work focuses on reconstructing ancient environments on early Earth and Mars, and she was a standing review board member for NASA's Perseverance rover. Professor Sumner, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for inviting me to join you.
All right. We'll get into the nitty-gritty of the science here in just a second, because I want to honor the fact that scientists have to maintain a certain rational skepticism even as they engage in these super exciting projects. But I want to start with that feeling of, is this an exciting moment for you, or for more broadly expanding science's understanding of early life in the solar system?
It's amazingly exciting. Every time we go to a new place, we discover new things. And on Mars, we've only investigated just a teeny number of places. And as Ken was saying earlier, the Perseverance rover has landed in a place that was once a lake, and we can see the river that used to flow into it, that riverbed. And so if there's a place on Mars that might hold those signatures of early life, this is one of the best places to look.
Mm. Now, let's talk for a second about what we've already found from previous Mars missions, right? If I remember correctly, and both of you, please correct me if I'm wrong, but did Curiosity, I mean, found organic molecules or organic molecular compounds on Mars. Is that right, Dawn?
Yes, it did. We used the Curiosity rover and the instrument that's nicknamed SAM to characterize a number of rocks, and we found different types of organic matter in several different rocks. One of the challenges with that instrument, though, is that to look at the organic matter, it has to heat up the sample or react it with chemicals. And the nature of the Martian rocks destroys those molecules at the same time we're trying to look at them. So we found evidence of organic molecules there, but we had a really hard time characterizing them.
Okay. And Ken, did you want to add to that?
So the take-home point, I think, is that indeed Curiosity found evidence of organic molecules, but that doesn't mean that that should be taken as evidence of ancient life. Organic molecules can come from many different sources. And recognizing the challenge that Dawn mentioned about heating the samples, the Perseverance rover has a completely different set of techniques for looking at organic matter, looking for organic matter. And the way Perseverance will do it is to, instead of heating up the rocks and extracting the organics, we will actually use a laser to interrogate the rocks and make a map of where we find organic matter in the rock. And there is some hope that we will find in the distribution, how it is in map view, where we find organic matter. We're hoping we can find evidence of a biogenic origin, uh-huh, or at least say something about the origin of that organic matter.
Okay, so how would you know the difference between biogenic and non-biogenic origins?
I think the simplest answer would be if you find a small spherical concentration of organic matter, you would be tempted to conclude that it was a cellular structure. I think that's a long shot. I think the preservation over billions of years is not all that likely. But the different sources of organic matter, we expect to be trapped in the rocks in very different ways. And so just looking for the overall pattern in the rock could tell us something about its origin.
Right. So, Dawn, let me turn back to you, because from my rudimentary layperson's understanding, it is absolutely true that this organic matter can come from a lot of different places. As Ken said, back in the day when I was in college, I had an amazing summer a little bit south of you, Dawn. I did a summer fellowship at the Scripps Institution at the University of California, San Diego. And my job that summer was to take carbonaceous meteorite and like pulverize it and smash it up and dissolve it in different ways and search for complex organic compounds in that meteorite. So that's something that, you know, it's not directly related to any extant life on Earth. It literally came from elsewhere in the solar system. I mean, it seems to me entirely possible that there might be a lot of that stuff too on Mars.
Yeah, that sounds like a fantastic summer job.
It was amazing. Yeah. I got to surf in the day and be in the lab at night.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that experience of yours looking for organic molecules in rocks, meteorites or rocks that come from places where we don't think there could be life, has taught scientists a lot about the fact that organic molecules are made by a lot of different processes. And in fact, the origin of life requires organic molecules to just get it kickstarted. And so we know that organic molecules are made without life, without the enzymes and processes of life. And those enzymes actually are organic molecules. So one of the interesting things about looking at organic molecules on Mars is that we don't know if they're coming from life or if they're coming from these other non-life processes that make those molecules. And in either case, we're learning a whole lot about how organic molecules work on another planet. We've never characterized them anywhere except Earth. And Earth is just covered in life. It's really, really hard to demonstrate that any organic molecule that's not, say, inside a meteorite is not from life.
Right.
And so it's this really interesting exploration.
Let me ask both of you. I mean, when we say life, we're operating with the presumption, or at least in this conversation, about recognizable life, i.e. the kind of life that we see here on Earth, which whittled down to its most elemental is DNA, essentially. Is it possible, though, that there would be signs of life on Mars that don't resemble how we would define it here, Ken?
I like to say that looking for life on Mars is potentially looking for life as we don't know it. Your suggestion that on Earth we have DNA-based life, absolutely. It is possible that DNA is a kind of a universal molecule and life elsewhere would discover the same approach. But I don't think that's necessarily true. And there's reason to believe that even if it is DNA-based, it will be a different, it will involve different compounds. And so at the end of the day, the challenge of looking for life, first of all, is to define what life is. And second of all, to figure out how you look for its signal without using the tools that have been honed so carefully over the last decades, which are focused on Earth's life that may not be universal. So that's a big challenge.
Don, how would you answer that?
Yeah. So as an astrobiologist, I feel like it's really important to have a model for what you're looking for that's based on what you know. And so that does require that we use life on Earth as a model for what we're looking for on Mars. The second component, though, is to always keep your question in mind if there's something different. The way we approach recognizing a different form of life is to take our observations and look for things that we can't explain with what we already know. So if we find an unusual material, we might try to first describe it in terms of the minerals we know, the sort of glassy substances we know, the nanoparticles, those sorts of things. And if none of those fit, then it's a candidate for being a new process. And one of those possible processes could be an unusual form of life.
I see.
So when you're looking for something you don't know if it exists and you don't know really what you're looking for, you have to really keep an open mind but always question what you're interpreting it as at the same time.
Yeah, that possibility of seeing something that's not yet explained by science. We've just got about a minute to go before the break here, and a lot of great questions coming in from On Point listeners. You guys are really terrific listeners. I love your questions. Okay, Michael John Hoffman wants to know more specifically, Don, in the minute before our break here, what could Perseverance find that would be proof positive of life?
It's very difficult to find proof positive evidence of life because there are so many ways to create different things and there are a lot of different opinions about what it would be. For me, if you found something that's much more like a shell that has a very complicated and symmetric structure, that would be good evidence of life. if I saw a sphere of organic matter, I would think, I don't know if that's a cell or a droplet of oil. Some people will interpret it as one, and some will interpret it as another. So proof positive is a really, really hard standard. I like the standard of suggestive.
Suggestive. Okay. Well, Dawn Sumner and Ken Farley, stand by. We are talking about the search for evidence, or at least suggestions of the possibility of ancient microbial life on Mars. We're getting a lot of good questions from On Point listeners on social media, so we'll hear more about that and those questions and their answers to them when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the search for possible evidence. Well, let me just even be more broad than that. The search for life or evidence of ancient microbial life on Mars. And I'm joined today by Ken Farley. He's project scientist with NASA's Mars 2020 mission. He leads the science team and worked with engineers to design and build NASA's Perseverance rover. He's also a professor of geochemistry at Caltech. Dawn Sumner also joins us as well. She's a professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of California, Davis. She was a standing review board member for NASA's Perseverance rover. And Dawn and Ken, I'd like to actually kind of almost do like a lightning round with you from some of these interesting questions that we've got from listeners, because then I want to spend the last part of the show talking about the big question about why we do this, why we make these searches. So first of all, Ken, here's a quick one. DR Shervish wants to know about that camera that we talked about earlier. What kind of camera was it? Was it a GoPro?
It was, in fact, not a GoPro, although that was the inspiration for it. I'm not sure exactly why a GoPro was ultimately found not to quite fit the bill. But it was another manufacturer, similar kind of camera.
Okay, but it's one you could get off the shelf.
That's right.
Are we allowed to say what it was?
We're allowed to, but I don't know the answer.
Okay, all right, fair enough. And Stan Soderstrom wants to know, if it's been 3.5 billion years since there was water on Mars, at what depth below the Martian surface now would one expect to find the most abundant evidence of life? Dawn, do you want to take that one?
Yes, sure. That is a super interesting question that scientists are trying to answer. We don't know. So there was the InSight lander on Mars that is trying to measure the temperature gradient near the surface of Mars. And the depth at which we might find liquid water depends on how deep you have to go until you reach the appropriate temperature. And we don't know the answer to that question, even though it's a really simple one. We measure that heat flow on Earth all the time, but we have not yet been able to do it on Mars.
Okay. Mark Fitz says, first, congratulations. And then Mark says, it's my understanding that Perseverance will eventually rover away from Ingenuity. Why weren't they connected electronically, say, by Bluetooth, so Ingenuity would be able to follow Perseverance? Ken, do you have an answer to that?
Well, effectively, they are in communication all the time. It's not Bluetooth, but it might as well be. And the fundamental issue is that Ingenuity is a technology demonstration. It was built to demonstrate capabilities. and then essentially conclude. And that means it was not built with the same ruggedness and survivability that every other component, the must-work components on the rover were built. So it has a finite lifespan just because of the way it was designed and built.
Mm. Okay. And then there's this question from D. Campbell, who says, please ask the guests about their view of the prevalence of life in the universe if signs of life are not found by on Mars. If life isn't found in a place that should have had so much life, then does this suggest life is more rare than we expect, even throughout the universe? And Don, what do you think about that?
So the way we sort of think about the likelihood of life on universe requires a lot of data points. There are billions of stars, and we're discovering that most stars have planets around them. Megna, your question earlier about looking for alternative life makes it extremely hard to calculate how likely life is elsewhere in the universe. Right now, we just have Earth, and we have this question about Mars, and that would be two places in one of the huge number of solar systems. And that gives us twice as many data points, but it's still not enough to really have a firm scientific understanding about how likely life is elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, that's two data points out of possibly billions, if not more.
Yeah. If we do find life on Mars and it's distinct from life on Earth, then that, to me, makes it much more likely there's evidence of life in the universe in other solar systems. If we don't find it, I don't know how to sort of, that doesn't really change my view that it's likely somewhere else as well.
Yeah, I mean, I just look at the sheer numbers and the vastness of space and the universe as far as, you know, we can measure it. It does not seem possible to me that in all of that space, that we're the only ones. It does not seem possible to me. Now, Don and Ken, hang on here for just a second, because, you know, a little earlier we did hint at, you know, maybe the possibility of one day having human beings step foot on Mars, maybe even having Martian settlements, because that idea, that dream has been part of at least science fiction for as long as there's been science fiction. And, you know, as much as I love the concept of seeing Bobby Draper's boot print in red soil someday, the question is, could that ever become fact? Well, the Mars Society is an organization that's founded by aerospace engineer Robert Zubrin, and they promote the exploration of Mars. And last year, they held a competition where aspiring explorers were asked to create plans for a permanent Martian city that could support 1 million people. Aerospace engineer Robbie Gittin and architect Sweya Tangadu, they're two members of the team that designed the city Phlegra Prime. And their entry was in the top five out of 175 total entries. And we talked to them. And Robbie told us that, in fact, it was the events of last summer here on Earth that pushed him to think about how to create a new society on a different planet.
With the murder of George Floyd and the protests that I was like participating in, that all kind of was the backdrop for this project. And it was always, encouraging me to think about, you know, how would we design a future community and how would we use Mars as this sort of space of the imagination to imagine, you know, what would an improved society be like? Because to me, that's the fun part of all this, is that space is provides us the imaginative space to dream better.
So what does the dream of Phlegra Prime look like? Well, Sweya says it's not a city under a dome.
We wanted to plan this as a combination of underground and overground structures. So the advantage with underground structures is they are naturally shielded from radiation. But at the same time, to feel that openness and not to feel confined all the time, we needed structures that are above ground as well. So there will be windows, there'll be glass facades, and they will be controlled as per the radiation intensity.
Radiation is one of the major hurdles humans would need to overcome in order to live on Mars. But it's not the only one, because the atmosphere is essentially devoid of oxygen. You heard that earlier. And Martian gravity is 60% less than gravity here on Earth. And it can get very, very cold there. So Suya says they tried to account for the fact that humans wouldn't be able to go outside.
You would find larger open spaces indoors that have nature, that have plantations, that have smaller animals, so that you can feel one with them. You don't feel away from home for a long time. You would also see that many of the things that they're built from would be usually the minerals that are found on Mars.
But the engineering is just the beginning. Then there are the social questions. Who gets to go first? What if there's conflict both on the way and there? How do you choose a leader? Both Robbie and Suya say they'd be game for living on Mars, but Robbie admits that the whole notion of settling other planets is not for everyone.
We have differences in opinion, and there are some people who want to go to a place like Mars and make it as Earth-like as possible. And there are some people who would want it to remain wild and as it is, even if there is no life. You know, they like the idea that it's out there and it's different and it's beautiful to them, and they want it preserved in that way. We really have to settle space in a way that respects both viewpoints, and that we don't irrevocably, you know, to go to these places is to alter them forever. And we need to be careful that we are altering them in a way that almost doesn't ruin their intrinsic properties.
That's aerospace engineer Robbie Gitten and architect Suya Tangadu talking about their ideas about future Martian settlements and their conceptual city-state, Phlegra Prime, which placed in the top 5 out of 175 entries in the Mars Society competition last October. Now, Ken Farley, obviously we are a long ways from even sending yet a person to Mars. But can you talk about how you think through the ethical implications of even putting, you know, rovers like Perseverance on an otherwise, well, I mean, mostly untouched planet?
Well, I can tell you that there's an interesting scientific slash ethical consideration, which is called planetary protection. And when decades ago, exploration of places like Mars began, it was recognized by the international community that if life existed elsewhere for at least some amount of time, we needed to prevent contaminating it with Earth-based life. And when the spacecraft that go to Mars now, that land on its surface, they must be essentially sterilized so that they do not bring microbes with them to inoculate the surface. And although some people view that as an ethical thing about protecting any native Martian biosphere, its original reason for existence was simply scientific. That as soon as humans come, it is unlikely that the whole effort can be kept clean enough to not inoculate the surface with Earth-based life.
Mm. And Dawn, does the same sensibility or set of concerns, they must exist in terms of returning samples from Mars to Earth?
Yes, it's really important in our evaluation of whether or not there was ever life on Mars to not contaminate the samples we take from Mars to Earth so that we can actually tell what is Martian. And scientists are very good at identifying contamination, but only if it's just a very small amount. And so keeping those samples clean, and in particular, we're not as worried about keeping them clean from living organisms in the sense that we don't think that the samples could have living organisms. So if we found one, we'd know it was contamination. The real key is keeping it clean from organic molecules. They're all over Earth on mm-hmm. every surface. And those molecules are going to be the key to trying to understand if life used to be present, if there's a biosignature, like a little footprint of microbial life in those samples. And the structure of those organic molecules will be one of the most important possible biosignatures.
Yeah.
So we really want to keep Earth-based molecules out of those samples.
Okay. Because cross-contamination, very much it would be a huge problem, right? That's a lot of time, human effort, and money spent to get the results messed up because of Earth-based molecules getting in the mix here. So we've just got a couple of minutes left. And Ken and Don, I know you've probably heard the question I'm about to ask many times, but we get it over and over again every time we do a space show. Every time we do a space show, someone like Alexander Gabbis sends us a message that says this, and this is what Alexander is saying today. He says, Mars, a big, huge, dead rock, hundreds of millions of miles away. We spend billions to explore it. I'd be more impressed if your guests journeyed 100 feet to engage with their neighbors. Alexander, you don't know that they're not doing that. But anyway, he goes on and says, and explores the relationship with community and the precious Earth under our feet. It is a colossal waste of time and resources. So, Ken, what is the argument for the effort and the money and the cost for exploring another planet?
Well, I disagree with the premise of the question. Just because we're doing this doesn't mean we're doing these, we're not doing these other things. And I would say that the amount of money that goes into this is modest compared to, for example, what we are dealing with right now with a pandemic. And I think the fundamental answer, though, is this is part of being human. Exploration, art, these are things that we do in addition to simply staying alive. And I think it has great value from that point of view and from the point of view of inspiring scientists of the future to go on and do great things that may have nothing to do with Mars exploration. It is part of the encouragement of a scientific, science-based culture.
Yeah, it seems to me that different forms of scientific exploration always get pitted against each other, right? I mean, he's talking about explore the precious Earth under our feet. I don't see why we can't do that and explore Mars at the same time. Whereas we don't question, well, why is the Defense Department budget, you know, more than $700 billion a year? I don't know why we pit good things against each other here. But Don, we just got a minute to go before we have to wrap up here. Let me just rephrase the question a little. What inspires you? What drives you to want to understand the origins of life, both on Mars and here on Earth?
For me, the study of Mars really helps me value what we have on Earth more. As Ken described earlier, Mars used to be warm enough to have liquid water. It used to be habitable, and it went through this change into this icy, barren rock, as the questioner said. That's a really dramatic planetary scale change. And on Earth, we're going through that due to our own activities with the environmental damage that we're doing. It's very difficult to predict what will happen. We can actually use other planets to try to see what happens when there are changes, what causes a planet to go cold and wet. In our case, I mean, cold and dry. In the case of Earth, we're getting warmer and warmer. Maybe it's a little bit more like Venus, which is super warm. But we need to study planets to understand Earth.
Yeah. Well, Don Sumner, professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of California, Davis, and standing review board member for NASA's Perseverance rover, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And Ken, you beat me to it. He's project scientist with NASA's Mars 2020 mission and a professor of geochemistry at Caltech. Thank you as well. Congratulations to both of you. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.